David A. Price presents...
Hello, folks. Welcome to Marvel Noise, episode 409. I'm your host, Steve Raker, enjoying the onset of spring that included a week with weather in the 80s, when the kids were off from school for Easter, too. Always lots going on in and around stately Raker Mansion that sits just a art-adorned corridor and staircase above the comic book bunker where I hole myself up in. Marvel Noise is a semi-monthly podcast with a scope covering all things Marvel that we consume and enjoy. You can always stream or download episodes past and present at marvelnoise.com. Plus, interact and get new episode announcements over on our Twitter and Facebook pages. We've got a lengthy recent reads roundtable for you on the back nine of this episode. But first, our feature segment, True Believers. Okay, our panel is present after being sequestered during the intro. Let me introduce you to Bachelor Number One. He's a high society lawyer residing in the City of Angels, hailing from the wastelands of northern New York. It's Andrew the LA Rabbit.
Wait, I thought that was Kevin's intro.
No, Bachelor Number Two is a high-tech mystery man whose origins remain a mystery. But we do know
that
he...
Am I a nihilist?
He now is in the, well, sort of hidden among the many scattered lakes of northern Canada. It's WWX Kevin.
I hear him by the Arctic Circle.
Closer than me.
North of the Arctic Circle.
Yeah, that was a whole bit from Indie Comic Book Noise. And then he said, well, are you even in Canada anymore?
The Icebox with eight X's.
All right, it's time to bring on the bad guys with another supervillain classic. This time we've got Blastar with two A's. You can figure out where which of the A's is the two A's.
You know, I thought it was two R's. Like, I couldn't remember. I was like, which one? How does he spell it again?
We've got two Silver Age and two Bronze Age appearances of Blastar, including his first. The first here being Fantastic Four 61-63, which was on the stands January to March of 1967, and that was a Kirby Lee Kirby and Joe Sinnott production.
With that weird Sandman costume cover, oof.
That's the first appearance of the new Sandman costume, too.
Yeah, I mean, still not a fan.
Well, I gotta say, I do feel like I was let down with my public education after this, because in the 60s, apparently you could just take some remedial science classes and build yourself a high-tech
yep.
battle suit with a refresher class.
Of course you could.
Now, Kirby often would start Fantastic Four issues already in the middle of some action. Like, that may or may not even have anything to do with the rest of the story. Or maybe it eventually will. You don't, but most of the time, you would just get, when he would pull this trick, it would be just in the middle of the end of some action, or it's almost like a James Bond movie, right? Where you start off in the middle of his last caper. And I think you will find that many times that this occurred, Stan would have some kind of dialogue or caption apologizing, like, just stick with us, readers, or, you know, we're just going to jump right into the... So I have a feeling this was something that Stan wasn't a favorite thing of Stan's, but it worked for me, and it was part of the Fantastic Four kind of constantly rolling over the action and characters and different scenes and stuff, starting right in the middle of an adventure that happened in between, issues, is kind of cool.
You well, think Stan had that, like those modern movies where they begin in the middle and then they go back and all that?
Well, yeah, there's that well, too.
Either you had to start with the fight or it's like Reed doing some crazy experiment and right. and Ben has to hold up some device or,
sure.
you know, some kind of pranksterism well, going on with the
torch. Well,
that's certainly
a take on the same thing. It's already something's going. We're joining the action, you know what I mean?
I really like the Galactus, coming at Galactus thing where you have like half of the Inhuman story.
Right.
And then like halfway through the issue, another story starts. Like, I really liked how that was split up.
Well, even though we're looking at 61 to 63, a few issues ago in issue 57 of the Fantastic Four, the issue opened with the Fantastic Four foiling a jailbreak by the Sandman and the Wizard at a bail hearing. And ultimately, the Sandman makes it free and also steals some tech of Reed Richards from the Baxter building, and that ends up being incorporated into this new costume of his. When this issue opens, 61, we find the team fighting off some like gravitational energy cannon thing that's shooting like wildly at them. And it turns out not to be Reed's science stuff gone bad, but rather it's the granular Sandman attacking them from inside the building. The call's coming from inside the house. So he's got a grudge from the kickoff of issue 57, and he's going to take it out on them now. And now he's got the Kirby-esque armor that, you know, he says helps him control his sandy form. Like, he's got this little dial on it that he can add things to his sand, like oil. Or maybe like glitter.
I'm thinking he's getting more like the Trapster.
Yeah.
Or that dial controls that one molecule that controls his whole form.
But what else would you want to add? Like, I'm thinking like maybe glitter for parties.
You're not going to add ice cream or anything like that.
Well, I feel the other thing is the spin attack that happens to Ben. I feel like that was a common kind of image of like the hero being spun around and rapidly in a circle. I was like, I wonder, there must be some whole blog devoted to just like images of the Silver Age of Marvel and heroes being spun in circles.
Yep. Kirby's shorthand as he's whipping through 5 pages a day. And also, I love Kirby's ugly faces on like the Latverian guards in the interlude with the surfer where he's, escaping captivity, and his Sandman face, you know, this ain't the Will and Grace guy. This is like, you know, one ugly dude. It was the Will and Grace guy who played him in the movie, right? Or was that a different actor?
No, he was the guy from the Merlot wine movie, wasn't he?
That's the guy?
Not Paul Giamatti, but the other
actor.
Well,
that's what I was thinking. I don't remember.
You remember the other guy that was in the movie? Gosh, boy, we're now this is going to be where everybody's mentally reaching back into their brain to find Thomas Hayden Church. That's the name.
That's the guy. Wasn't he in a sitcom? I thought so.
Wings, I think, or something. Was he one of the guys on that one? I mean, that was a sitcom, right? I don't think I watched it, but
I don't think I ever saw an episode. But yeah, that was like.
Yeah, I think I watched most of that show. Not that I remember it anymore.
It was like one of Fox's first shows, wasn't it? Something like that. That was way back.
I don't think it was it that far? Oh, it could have been. Because it probably was in the same era of Seinfeld and everything.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway.
It's so funny to think in a couple years, this guy, like a few years ago, was defeated by a vacuum cleaner, by the way.
Yep. Yeah.
Then you
He's
like
come
Kirby.
A long way.
Yep. For sure. And the Fantastic Four was such a fast-paced book. Like, in this issue alone, you get the Silver Surfer, the Inhumans, Wyatt Wingfoot, and even a Peter Parker cameo, as well as the villain and the heroes. That's a team. So there's all these characters. It's such a fun era of the book. During the fight with the Sandman, stuff is broken, and the Sandman breaks a window and escapes. But Reed gets pulled into the negative zone portal, which was first seen just 10 issues ago, in issue 51, This Man, This Monster was the first appearance of the Negative Zone. And we don't learn about, like, Annihilus being the ruler of the Negative Zone or anything like that for another year or so in the summer of 68 in Fantastic Four Annual 6. So it's a real unknown quantity.
See, I was trying to figure out how the Negative Zone worked by this story, which is something you shouldn't try to do. It's so weird because I'm like, Reed's just giving up almost right away. He's like, ah, you can't find me. I'm dead. Bye, guys. Later. And we're like, okay.
I also think it's cool that it's during these issues, this is just a fun fact for everyone, the corner box of the covers, it was during these issues that they would start having three heads and one full figure of one of the characters and have it rotate which character gets the little full figure. It's kind of cool. Anyway, in 62, back when those corner boxes really mattered. Believe you me, there was a time.
You didn't like the Vision being on the Avengers one forever?
I kind of did. I thought it was cool, especially when he like kind of came out of the A. But those burn faces, those are the good ones. But we'll get to those, actually. In FF62, there's a double-page black-and-white collage Negative Zone spread. There's a mid-issue splash, too, and it's just so cool.
Pushing the boundaries.
I have a question about Blastar, though, because they bring it up in one of these appearances. He shoots them through his fingers, but at some point, like, they say something like, oh, his race of people, they can generate energy inside their body and shoot it out. And I'm like, it doesn't specify that he has to shoot it out of his fingers.
Maybe so they're all...
I was just like, yeah. Whoa.
Stay away from Blastar if he's got like a heavy cold.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, they've established that they have the other one I like is the communication system. It's Kirby Tech, but it's designed like a World War II style radio unit, kind of, where it, like there's a dial and Grimm's holding it. So it's with Kirby Tech. And it just made me laugh how like different conceptions of sci-fi devices make him look kind of like a 40s radio man meets a bunch of strange knobs and devices and everything. But that's how they're able to communicate with Reed in the zone.
The whole scene where Blastar comes into play is so neat. There's a convict felon that's encapsulated in some kind of cocoon-like prison being brought to the far reaches of the Negative Zone and gets attached to this floating piece of debris to be stranded and marooned forever. And in one panel, they show the humanoid cocoon on the asteroid, and in the next, you see Reed helplessly clinging to some rocks. And after the page turn, you get a full page splash showing the entire asteroid with Reed on one side of the same asteroid that the cocoon is sitting exactly on the opposite side. It's a really cinematic reveal. I thought it was really cool, executed really well.
Man, Reed's the perfect guy to get, you know, you think, you know, he's going to be musing on scientific wonderies till he finally dies of floating through the air, you know, calculating him probabilities and everything.
Yeah, because even back then, that's how the asteroid belt in the Negative Zone worked. It's in a decaying, collapsing orbit towards an exploding disintegration zone that separates the Negative Zone from Earth's dimension. Fortunately, Crystal, Johnny's sometime girlfriend and sometime team member of the FF, is visiting and tries to help by seeking out the rest of her royal family. They're in battle defending their hidden city from a private armed force of commandos. So we get to see the Inhumans in action, which is cool.
Yeah. And Blastar is a fun because he's super arrogant, but has that like streak of kind of cowardice about him too, that makes such a fun mix of complete arrogance, but deep down, like the classic bully almost, you know.
Sure.
You know what? I think I posted a picture of Blastar, and then Bobgar told me, oh, it's Blue Calibac. And I was like, huh, you know, I never thought about that before.
a lot of the Negative Zone is very fourth world.
Yeah.
But it's funny, since Kirby designed both, you can't really, you know, there's some All-Father stuff happening with Blastar. There's some, you know, this guy and that guy. I'm pretty sure I saw, who's the guy who's like the bug type of guy. Anyway, I'm pretty sure I saw the same design for that guy in one of the Negative Zone denizens. But
anyway, he has, that giant mane around his head.
Sure.
Yeah.
So getting the Inhumans' help, they figure out the perfect solution is they get Triton to travel to the Negative Zone. He is the water-based Inhuman, so it makes sense, because is not space a vast sea, Kevin?
I guess it's the same thing.
Who better to navigate, find, and rescue someone in the vastness of the sea here? And you get to see all these wonders through his eyes, and he's using this cool gun to propel himself, which I think is...
Yeah, that was weird, too.
Very cool.
Well, you can't say they're not earning their money. With between the Thing and Triton, that's a lot of little marks here. His armor, his body is like all these scales. So it's just a crazy amount of little scales. Yeah, and then
for sure.
Ben Grimm with all his plates and everything. I'm sure at some point they're like, ugh, why do we design these guys like that? Maybe they just need to wear a bag or something for an outfit.
Triton finally reaches and rescues Reed, but Blastar gets free and follows Triton and Reed using his fingertips for propulsion, as Andrew was saying. And when Triton and Reed come back, no one notices Blastar come through the portal afterwards.
And apparently he needs to set up an alarm on that, so when something comes through, he's aware of it.
Yep. And when Blastar pokes his head out of the Baxter building window to, like, look around and see where he is, he gets attacked by the Sandman, who was out there waiting to ambush whoever came out of the building. But then,
smart, because then you can team them up.
All right.
See, I predict a supervillain team up.
Yeah, they team up, but they don't trust each other.
Right? Yeah, because Blastar is like, I need a tour guide. And Sandman's like, all right, I'm your man, I guess.
And they fight.
I got to keep on showing him how strong I am so he doesn't turn on me.
That's a common theme, isn't it, of these Negative Zone guys?
Yeah.
They fight the Fantastic Four and Triton. Minus,
what a great battle sequence. But my favorite of these three is the Triton against Blastar.
Yeah, Triton does pretty good.
You know, Kirby's still 63 issues in, still laying it down like nobody's business.
The pages are so powerful, aren't they? Boom, boom, boom. Really are. Triton does pretty good until he gets sandblasted. That never works good for a guy with gills. Johnny and Crystal come upon Sandman and Blastar on the street, and they fight. And the Thing comes along to help. I like the Thing's move of holding Blastar's hands at his own face, right? That's a good one. Sandman rolls the Thing away and into the East River. But the Thing wrecks the dock, and Sandman disperses in the water, escaping, which leaves Blastar. Fortunately, Reed's got a thingamajiggy that'll, you know, stop him from building up a charge, so to speak. But it's a helmet, right? So then you get the whole chaoticness of, like, you know, quit squirming. We gotta try to get it on you, you know? Bouncing around. It's like those Dark Phoenix things. We gotta get the helmet on the Dark Phoenix.
Yeah.
Like, good luck with that. Beast. Anyway, it takes a few tries, but they finally get it on him and it works. And then Reed can kick his butt, you know, up to the east side and back. And then Ben shows up just in time to carry the Blastar icicle back to their headquarters.
He's heavy.
And a debut of Stan's Soapbox. For nice. Those of you that are fans in that one. And we're not going to cover 64, but the Stan Soapbox there has a funny little bit in it, because it quotes a letter from a Mark Evan Iyer.
in Los Angeles? I wonder if we'll hear anything of this Mark person in the comic world later on. I love when, like, we're going to see that later on, too, how, like, future professionals were writing letters back in the day.
For sure. Especially those who ended up in, like, editorial, you know? In December 1968, we jump to X-Men 53. Nice 12-cent comic written by Arnold Drake with pencils by Barry Windsor Smith and inks by Michael D., who we've also seen as Mickey Demo, but his real name is Mike Esposito, and this is back in the days when working for Marvel and DC at the same time wasn't the best thing for the DC side of things, so a few guys used pseudonyms when they came over to Marvel.
That is a weird cover.
I'm not sure he's earned his Windsor in this one, Steve. I think he's still just Barry Smith at this. He needs a little bit more polish. The face also has that weird...
Well, it's Esposito.
Sometimes, a little bit too. But it's a fun... If you wanted to see Marvel Girl in the shortest mini skirt...
No kidding.
...allowed by the
I know.
Code.
Right. I do... You said the cover, though, Kevin. I like this cover a lot, actually.
I mean, fine. It's just... It like, if you just look at it, you would almost think that Cyclops is trying to, like, kick him in the head. But
or if you know Blastar's power, where's Blastar about to shoot Cyclops right in the groin?
Yes,
he's about to blast him. He's like open, like Chuck Norris, going for a roundhouse kick, and it's really he's being thrown. Is what it's supposed to be, but. And it would be great for one of those 2 seconds later commissions that you see sometimes.
And then the Beast is being clobbered just like when he walks towards Blaster in the issue. And I'm like, that's probably not the wisest.
Yeah, that at least is accurate advertising. That scene does happen inside the issue. Blaster's floating around the outskirts of the negative zone, having himself a midlife crisis. When the issue opens, like, this man needs a planet to conquer already, right?
Does.
And meanwhile, Jean Grey's doing an experiment, which we've already guessed might be to see just how short her skirt can be before the comics code steps in. But the test with this machinery that she's hooked up to goes wrong, and a portal is accidentally opened that allows Blastar into the school for gifted youngsters.
And some of the negative zone leaks in, Steve, because some of the perspectives and proportions have been altered by the negative zone in the next few pages.
Blastar blasts the Beast unconscious and uses his finger blasts to, like, launch himself into the air, and he can punch out the Angel.
Yeah, it's weird. You'd think the Angel would be more maneuverable, considering he has, like... sort of directional thrusts only, but the Angel gets fallen prey. And then I do like the innovative use of, you know, back in the 60s, the powers were whatever they needed to be. So they create an army of Iceman clones powered by Jean Grey's telekinesis.
That's, I mean, it seems like they feel pain, right? When they get hit, they're like, oh, it's like golems he creates and Gene controls with their telekinesis. How about he also awakens the unconscious Beast by
a whiff of frozen oxygen?
slipping him a whiff of frozen oxygen, but not too much, or otherwise he'll freeze his brain. Like, oh my God.
Yeah, and they said, oh, the Iceman never does anything. His powers were never used. And I'm like, well, I mean, back when they just did anything, I mean... Few moments here.
After the skirmish is just kind of getting going, it's like just as suddenly as he appeared, Blastar seems to almost melt into the wet floor like the Wicked Witch, you know? I'm melting. Because it turns out the water from the melted ice warriors short-circuited Blastar's connection to the energy that was coming from the machine that malfunctioned that opened up the portal. And it puts him in a coma, although they think he's dead. But later you see that he gets transported to some facility in upstate New York.
Man, I still love the as long as there's evil in the world, Blackstar lives there too. Like he's some kind of magical sprite or something.
Yeah, he's an abstract entity.
It's a weird. And then this one, for those interested, a letter was published by a Mark Gruenwald. That's an unusual name. I wonder if we'll hear from him again, young Mark. I mean, I assume it's got to be the same.
It is.
Mark Gruenwald. I can't imagine there's a bunch of them writing letters. But yeah, I love that. Reading these letters and, oh, look who that is.
For sure. All right. 9 years later, in January and February of 1978, Thor 269 and 270 would hit the stands. Written by Len Wein, with art by Walt Simonson on his first go around on Thor, just as a penciler, and Tony DeZuniga with his usual heavy but good inks. I really like the cover of 69 because it's got the Joe Sinnott inks, and I mean, Sinnott on Thor is like Sinnott on Namor. So handsome, you know? He does a great Thor.
I thought you meant like Sinnott on Stiltman, Steve.
Yes.
Good old Stiltman.
I mean, that seems like a bit of a mismatch.
Yeah, I know. How's Thor going to survive?
Well, it's going to be an amped up Stiltman, but before we get there.
Oh, he got the cosmic powers like Spider-Man?
Blastar had one appearance between these issues and the X-Men one, which was in Marvel Team-Up 18 in November 1973. Where a scientist helped create Faust, which was a moniker for fully automated unit of structural technology, which becomes like an AI nightmare. And the scientist revives Blastar from his coma and imbues him with gamma radiation and sets him off to the task of destroying this Faust computer. And the Hulk and the Human Torch team up and stop him. So in these Thor issues, the Faust computer is the like big bad in the shadows, and he has Blastar as his servant and uses Blastar and Stiltman to steal this box of radioisotopes that's going to help him. It's going to help the Faust become mobile.
And the Marvel team up is on the Unlimited and footnoted.
Excellent.
So I made sure to read it, and totally worth it for Gil Kane up nose shots, which I forever love. But it's one of those ones where it's Human Torch, not Spider-Man.
Yeah.
And they do the wheeze where they lure the Hulk in to do the heavy lifting. And I'm like, oh, man, that guy's always a sap getting to do other people's work. But yeah, totally fun. Check it out. And I'm reading the Thors on the Unlimited, too. So you can follow along at home. Now, I presume the Fantastic Four are, but I'm reading all that stuff on my CD-ROMs.
They are. So it's this Faust AI technology computer program thing trying to get this isotope that is using Stiltman and as an agent. And to do that, that's how Stiltman's suit gets all souped up. And that's when it first becomes adamantium, which you definitely down the line hear him make references to the adamantium legs or the this or the that, and he didn't always have it, and here's where he got it.
Yeah, it's expensive now.
Yeah, especially the expandable version.
His legs.
I mean, boy, imagine how many Build-A-Figure parts that took, Kevin.
That's what we need, a Stiltman Build-A-Figure.
You know, that's one of the sad things, that I was never able to complete the Stiltman.
There was one?
What part are you missing? Yeah. And they made the legs were a army builder. So if you want to buy
I think I have multiple legs.
You could get them.
Oh, that's very cool.
I think, what was it? Was it the body I was missing? I'm not sure. I would have to check. But yeah, it's just, it was one of those awkward waves where doesn't always work out for you.
So Stiltman steals the case with the isotopes in it from a helicopter. And that's how Thor gets involved, because he spies the out-of-control helicopter with the unconscious pilots and catches it before it crashes. Then Thor seeks out and attacks the Stilt Man, and oh, what a battle it is. I mean, really, it actually is a really good battle.
Yeah, very dramatic, with lots of collateral damage and extra weaponry, and I like it when Stilt Man just books it out of there. He's like, I can be gone before this guy knows what day of the week it is.
Thor ends up winning with a lightning bolt. It's the old storm frog thing, right? You can't dodge a lightning bolt.
Although they should really call Stilt Man High Pockets, not just Giant Man.
And then Thor gets sucker punched by Blastar and separated from his hammer. And this is back in the days where he only had 60 seconds or he turned back to Don Blake. So he's trying to fight Blastar to get back to his hammer and gets thrown into an alleyway. And when Blastar comes after him, it's Don Blake sitting there saying, Thor went that away. So with Stilt Man apprehended and Thor getting his hammer back, with Blastar chasing on a wild goose chase, I should say, Thor ends up getting Iron Man to help him track Blastar. And he finds him and they fight some more until Faust betrays Blastar on whatever deal they had and blasts off into space like a rocket.
Steve, you can't trust robots. I thought we learned that lesson before.
Poor dumb Blastar. Has a rule against AI.
And then Blastar leaps through a portal that sends him back to the negative zone, where it's funny, he'd sit until almost 2 years later in November 1979 when Dr. Sun, the floating brain enemy of Dracula, would inhabit Herbie the Robot and mess with the FF's negative zone portal, allowing Blastar to return and create a bunch of havoc in Fantastic Four 215 and 216 until Franklin's powers returned and his eyes got all crazy looking and he puts a real whammy on Blastar and sends him back to where he came from. And this was really significant because Franklin's powers had been dormant since way back in Fantastic Four 150. In 1974, so Blastar ends up being a pretty significant catalyst, even if he's just passing through.
And those are footnoted in our last book, so oh, cool. I also read those too. I love when the footnotes, bring back the footnotes, man. I'm always, when I see a footnote, and if it's something easily available, I'm like, I got time for a detour.
I've seen some footnotes lately.
Now, Blastar is next seen a little more than a year after that, in February 1981, when Marvel 2-in-1, the other team-up book, reached its double-sized issue 75, which also cost 75 cents. The Thing you and look the at Avengers. That,
you see this in, like, your dollar or $2 bin? How do you not, like, look at that and say, oh, that looks interesting.
This was a great cover to pick up off the racks. I mean, it's got this Kupperberg Sonat cover with the action happening, Blastar and everyone fighting on floating asteroids in the negative zone. And then you've got the vertical sidebar that features the John Byrne Avengers floating heads. It's great.
Also, you're like, how are the good guys going to win? Annihilus, Blastar, Super Adaptoid, and random spaceships against Thing, Hawkeye, Beast, Wasp, and Captain America. They are seriously outgunned.
Yeah.
Guys, I don't know how you're beating that superpower.
Although you might not know that Super Adaptoid at the time.
Well, what do you think? It's just a really poorly drawn Iron Man?
Iron Man's like, well, I'm in the negative zone, so I gotta create a new suit of armor. Green is what I'm going with this time.
We knew who the Super Adaptoid was.
The colorist.
Thanks to Marvel 2-in-1 and Marvel Triple Action. I mean, Marvel Triple Action and Marvel Super Action reprinting those and stuff.
Oh, I love the Super Adaptoid.
So this was written by Tom DeFalco with art by Alan Cooperberg and inks by Chick Stone, although definitely with help from others. There's a few pages here that I am pretty sure are inked by Michael Golden, possibly, but definitely not all Stone. And this issue also features one of my favorite often used Marvel 2-in-1 plots, where the Thing's poker game gets interrupted by a distress call. The Thing, Ben, is there with Cap, Iron Man, Beast, Hawkeye, Jarvis, and the Wasp tagged along for the poker game. And I like how Ben didn't let Jarvis serve them. He's like, no, 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 no. Here, you're an equal player. I'll get the sandwiches in a minute, he says.
Well, the other thing I like is when they're leaving, like, so the rest of them, I got to bug out so they can set this up. And Reed is full with the pipe, and he looks, I don't know if you guys ever knew that, like, Church of the Subgenius and the whole Bob thing, but he looks right out of that image, for those of you that remember the short period of time when that was kind of a weird thing. But yeah, I feel like they lifted that, this image of Reed with the pipe for the that particular weird thing, pre-internet days.
So what leads to the distress call is that Blastar came knocking on Annihilus's door and offered to lead his armies against his own well-protected home planet. Blastar's, that is. So we get to hear how Blastar was like the ruler of his planet and then exiled, which was how he got in the cocoon and dropped off on that asteroid back in Fantastic Four 61. And we learn that his planet has these hidden catacombs, but Blastar knows the secret entrances so he can get Annihilus's armies there, which Annihilus has never been able to do.
I like how they're circling. Talk about, you think the Sandman and Blastar was an uneasy alliance.
You're right.
Annihilus can't practically help but say how much he wants to crush Blastar.
How unbelievable that it's been 2 decades of stories and with the Negative Zone, and this is the first time Blastar and Annihilus have even crossed paths.
It's funny. He's like, I've heard about you.
Yeah, hilarious. So Blastar was also taken from his queen all those years ago, and then he sees her in Annihilus's arena. She's alive, and they get reunited.
I love that she just looks like a regular woman with Blastar's head on her.
Blastar, despite finding her, he still wants to lead the attack on his home world. Like, she'd rather he not be associating with Annihilus, but when the assault begins, it's her that's the one who sends the Avengers the distress call that the Thing and the Avengers hear. And it's funny because they debate helping. It's like, number one, the Negative Zone sucks. And number two, that's a pretty ugly damsel in distress. Am I right?
Yeah. Except she looks like I said, from the neck down. They could have done something to make them look, I don't know. I would have preferred, it's just weird because it looks like some Planet of the Apes outtake.
Yeah, for sure. But they're heroes, so they go, right? And also the Wasp is dying to know what fashions they're wearing in the Negative Zone.
Ooh.
And in addition to Blastar's service, as the cover suggested, Annihilus also has the Super Adaptoid working for him, who he had found floating around since Captain Marvel 50, when the... See, this is one thing that I didn't like about the Adaptoid, is like that... How does he adapt? How did he mimic? So he mimics Captain Marvel's Nega Bands right down to their like cosmic enchantment, so that when Mar-Vell knocked them together, he went into the Negative Zone, as would happen with Mar-Vell's Nega Bands when he would switch places with Rick Jones floating in the Negative Zone. So they clicked the Adaptoid's fake Nega Bands, but they worked just as good as the real ones. And sent him to the Negative Zone where Annihilus found him.
Looks like they missed a chance for a Rick Jones cameo, Steve. Yeah.
So in the next sequences, we get a lot of action. I mean, Avengers versus a space fleet, Avengers versus Negative Zone weirdos, the thing versus Blastar, the Thing and Cap versus the Super Adaptoid, Iron Man versus Blastar. It's good stuff.
Well, if we've learned anything from that Nebula versus the Avengers, they like fighting in outer space. I mean, literally floating in space.
And there's not as much subtlety to, like, these heroes being interstellar murderers. Like, they're like Iron Man's flying through ships, just blowing up people left and right. And it's, but what's also cool is this is Annihilus's annihilation wave, right?
Yeah, it must be.
This is kind of one of the first times we're really seeing it as a, you know, as a whole big squadron like this.
Going I also planet enjoy, to planet. Enjoy the ultimate indignity because the super adaptoid has dropped Hawkeye's adaptions. You know,
yes.
Like, I have all these other heroes. Let's give a pass on the bow and arrow.
It's too bad because I loved the mask and the, you know, how it made him look.
Yes, that was but I just thought it was the ultimate slap in the, I could absorb your abilities, but it's a bow and arrow. I'm good.
Blastar's girl frees Hawkeye, the Wasp, and the Beast after they're captured, and Annihilus kills her for it. Then the Thing defeats the Adaptoid with just his sheer stubborn tenacity. And Blastar leads Annihilus's wave into an ambush. It's a trap. You see, Blastar had retaken his kingdom months ago, so he didn't actually need Annihilus to help him retake it. It was all a ruse to bring Annihilus's fleet into this hornet's nest crossfire. And there goes the annihilation wave. And yoink, Blastar grabs Annihilus's cosmic control rod right off his chest and splits.
Phew. Wow. I mean, Annihilus is always proclaiming and yelling about how it's the awesomest thing ever.
It is.
So.
It is.
But it's also like that. The realization suddenly, you know, Blastar makes a big deal that he finds his ex-queen. And I'm like, so he just blew that part off for the months.
Yeah.
He's all broken up. But is he that broken up, really?
Now who rules the negative zone? But without your queen, pretty much. But I do like the, you know, you just grab the control rod and split. Like, you don't even look at it there. I'm going to go get behind a bush somewhere and look at it, you know? My precious. Well, the gang returns home. They've got the Adaptoid in tow, much to Jarvis's surprise. But you don't got to worry about Annihilus, kids, because he'd get his cosmic control rod back 5 years later in Fantastic Four 290, which was one of Byrne's last issues. But that's a pretty good sampling of Blastar in the Silver and Bronze Age. And really, I mean, there really wasn't much to the character as far as any real character development, really, until the whole Annihilation event of the 2000s, right?
Yeah, he was pretty big in that.
So you think when they brought the Super Adaptoid back, could it absorb people's bluffing ability? Would it be the ultimate poker player?
You remember when he started adapting to the Thunderbolts, but it was the wrong Thunderbolts?
Oh, yeah.
And they started freaking out, going, why is he taking our supervillain identities?
Yeah, that's funny. also funny, though, let's not skip over Andrew's rewriting of what the last panel of this comic totally should be. And that's them all playing poker, but like everyone having like a frustrated or like annoyed face because all the chips are in front of the Adaptoids.
Yeah.
where the Adaptoids are sitting at the table, where he's made himself at home a little too much, too at home. That would be good. Wait, what do they say on Monty Python? And now for something completely different. Let's hit a few recent reads. Always got time for a few recent reads, right?
Yeah.
Of course you do.
I was like, what's a good joke where I say I actually read a reading or look through or whatever, a book instead of a comic book proper?
What if it's a recent read, but it's not in the current continuity, Steve?
Dope. We here on Marvel Noise make exceptions whenever we feel like it, don't we? So don't you worry. As a matter of fact, you've piqued my curiosity.
Well, I picked up the Joe Fixit series. That's the Peter David Sinar book where it's set back with the Hulk used to be Joe Fixit, so it's set in that. So it's not really don't know if I'm enjoying it. I like Peter David and his take on the Hulk. And the Joe Fixit, at the time, I thought it was just kind of a strange thing to do with the Hulk. But I think I mentioned before, the Hulk, I feel, kind of out of all the kind of big iconic Marvel superheroes, there have been runs of his I like, but there are also runs of his I feel are just kind of like, eh, Hulk mad, Hulk smash, Hulk go to sleep in a field. So having Hulk as Joe Fixit is fun. And this one pits him with Spidey, and he's in Las Vegas as an enforcer for the mob. And it mixes up with another mob character, the Kingpin. So Spider-Man, Hulk, Kingpin, Larry David, Sinar art with Cunniff and Mila on colors. I only have the first issue, but I'm going to get, you know, assuming I see them, the other ones. It's a fun era. Also, the other slight advantage to the out-of-continuity stuff is I don't have to worry about, like, what other weird issue I forgot to pick up that crosses over. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, oh, you needed to pick up Ghost Spider number 7 that came out 3 weeks ago and sold out because it's the first appearance of Aunt May's long-lost niece's nephew's gardener, who is now an important character in the MCU.
Wow.
I think I have that issue.
Don't sell it, Steve. It's worth $1 billion now. They only printed 3 of them, and someone bought all 3, so...
Wow, manufacturer's scarcity, too. Well, you know what doesn't have manufacturer scarcity? Actually, I don't know.
What's that?
But if you have you heard of this X-Men, the art and making of the animated series?
Yes, I have, because I'm a big fan of Will Mignot, who was the art director, I believe, on that show, and certainly did a lot of art for it. I have a bunch of storyboards from Mignot from that show, actually. And when he was talking about that book being made and I saw it for a major, major discount, I had to pick it up. And it's awesome.
Would you believe I didn't know anyone that worked on the show until now? So I looked, I'm looking at the names and I'm like, I know that name.
Well, I know like the directors and producers or some of the people associated with the show used to tour the local con scene in LA hard, like every local show they were at. And since, what, 2 years ago when they announced they're doing a sequel, they've really gotten a lot more kind of attention and press. And it's been kind of cool that like they used to just, you know, have a table at some little show. And now that there's more heat on it, they're getting a much larger presence and larger, you know, panels and bigger turnouts and everything. So I think it's cool that, you know, the sequel is going to come out. I'll watch it. I don't know when the cartoon is dropping, but I'll check it out.
Hopefully this year, so we don't have another coolometer with the cartoons being on the bottom again.
Yeah, you got to work on that. 2 years in a row.
I know, right?
I don't want to date the show by saying what year it is, Kevin, in case, you know, it doesn't come out.
So sorry, we're doing recent reads, so.
But yeah, I guess I've been getting into process mode. I guess I've been watching videos, listening to things and whatever. And then, you know, you're like, oh yeah, they did that book on the anime series. And yeah, like they have a lot of cool storyboards and designs and memos and everything you basically want to see about the animated series. And it's so weird because it's the 90s. So it's like maybe like your season could be like 65 episodes long, or maybe they order like 6 episodes and then, oh, we want now 35.
Yep.
Like it's just so crazy.
And in animation, you can't catch up, right? I mean, geez.
I know. So yeah, like definitely worthwhile to, check out all that craziness.
'Tis a good history.
That's for sure. I guess I could have used a little bit more on like the last season and how you go from being like the most popular show to well, we got to get up to 65. Then we can't make any more money. Like, that's always the weird transition.
Yep. For sure.
Hey, things go from hot to, like, it's everywhere. And then it just kind of, there was a time when the Walking Dead TV show was the talk of all the cable. And now it's wrapped up.
Things, and now it has, three or four shows. And, no, you said it wrapped up, though.
Yeah, isn't the last, series ended?
There's spinoffs, though.
Yeah, but those movies I don't think are ever coming out. Because they were supposed to do them with that Australian actor that played Rick, and none of that ever came out.
But this is Marvel noise. This is Marvel noise.
So, Andrew, was there a courtroom?
Courtroom where? What?
Hey. Oh, never mind.
I read it, or am reading, an interesting limited series that I wasn't sure what I wasn't even sure what it was, and then I wasn't sure what to make of it, and then after the third issue, four have come out to this point, I was totally on board, even though I wasn't really reading it. And that is The Deadly Neighborhood Spider-Man.
Oh.
This is written by Taboo and B. Earl.
Werewolf by Night guys.
With art by Juan Ferreira. And the art is awesome and mystical. And did I say mystical? Well, he fights the demon bear. It's Spidey versus the demon bear from the old Sienkiewicz New Mutants, and it's wild, and Spidey's got like these flames that are coming out of his eyes that wrap around to the back of his head and like go off like it's Ghost Rider's flames or something, and it's all crazy and design wild, and honestly, and I know this is a little bit of sacrilege, but like the demon bear has never looked better. I mean, he looks really, really, really cool. Looks like something. That's where I was going. Looks like something with form. It's wild looking. And like I said, I admit I'm cheating a little bit. I've slowed down on actually reading all of the prose necessarily, but the visual ride is a psychedelic visual journey for sure. A lot of fun.
It sounds like it. Although it'd be hard pressed to do something as different as the demon, you know what I mean? Like when it came out, I think you have to give the demon bear some props for,
of course.
And when it came out, it was doing something that wasn't seen in a lot of mainstream superhero books.
Absolutely. It's way cool. And it's still cool.
Well, I finished up the Thunderbolts series.
Oh, I was going to read that.
Yeah, I thought you were going to warn me off it, Kevin. So,
yeah. So, well, I was warning you off on issue four. Now you get to tell me if it came back around for issue five.
A little bit, but they really drag the four. The gimmick in four, they drag. It goes on way too long in four and goes on way too long in five, in my opinion. But you see the heel is turned, so to speak, and so the gimmick wraps up. But I think it dovetails to listeners for our indie show where Andy talks about his feeling on dream sequences and everything. And yeah, it definitely goes on for a long time. And I'm like, come on.
The series kind of becomes Hawkeye and the Thunderbolts.
You got five issues. Let's not kill 20% or more of your story in a extended dream sequence.
Yeah.
But fun, you know, it was fun to see new characters created and everything. I just feel like, you know, this was your chance to get Thunderbolts back in. And there was some wasted space in there, in my opinion. I'm sure some people are like, oh, no, I love, you know, the alternate dream type sequences where, you know, it's not really happening, but it's sort of happening in their heads. That's awesome. Give me 20 issues of that. But I just feel like with five issues, man, make your hit with the Thunderbolts because it needs to last.
Well, I think that was his hit since it was his second try. but it was much like reading the Fight Club Thunderbolts. You're like,
Also gets a little preachy. I think Zub can run that way. And hey, I like messages in my comics too, but I prefer them with a little less, you know, over the top. And I know I'm a guy that's read a ton of like 60s and 70s and 80s.
Yeah, but I don't know.
So far be it for me to knock, but it would, like I said, I like the two new characters bringing into the fold. I just feel like in all, we lost a little bit of a chance to bring back the Thunderbolts. Like I said, I was hoping for a good 25 to 40 issue run.
Oh, no. No.
Not of this.
No, not like this. No, yeah. When the movie comes out, we'll get another series, so I'm not worried.
Yeah, but all the other problem is they're sort of picking up and dropping these things, and it's in some ways just becoming a name that is having less meaning.
Yep.
As it goes on. It's like becoming the Champions. It's
already been like that.
Where it's sort of watered down branding, for lack of a better term. Like, what is, when a new Champions book is released, does it mean anything to any, you know what I mean? It has little significance in the name. And I don't want Thunderbolts to reach that point where you're just like, oh, it's just another team book.
Yep.
I mean, you could say Thunderbolts is as unimportant as the Champions. Like, people say, oh, Doctor Strange isn't important. He never did anything. And then I'm always there, well, at least he got 200 issues or something. So the Thunderbolts, same thing.
Well, I feel like Thunderbolts, at least you have the rough concept of, like, reformed bad guys. Sort of like Defenders are the reluctant heroes.
I'm glad you used the example of reformed bad guys. That's how I know if someone's a Thunderbolts fan or not.
So I feel like those, but like I said, those brands are kind of getting wavered, because in this group, I don't feel like there were necessarily a big, and you don't even need the same cats. I mean, I guess Egro was the reformed bad guy that they were, and maybe we didn't get too much of the backstory of Machine Man or whatever the new guy is. Fighter Justice or Gun Boy.
Gets in Glory?
Yeah, that's Gun it. Gun Boy. Look, I can't remember these Liefeldian type names that they give these guys.
At least we got Liefeld upset and exploding on Twitter. How dare this come out and everything. And I'm like, relax.
Well, it's over now, so.
Yeah, exactly. Probably never to be used again.
But I would see Egro again, these characters again. Like I said, maybe a few more reform baddies on the team. Because, like I said, keep that branding. They've kept it with Defenders. How many minis have they had where they're always still kind of the weirdly reluctant team that doesn't want to be a team? They managed to keep that through line through the 6 or 7 different series they've had. So you can do it.
I'm still pining for the day when that villain Thunderbolts team shows up and then Melissa and Carla are there and going, you're not the real Thunderbolts, real. You know how I feel about the word real. And then they get into it.
Yep.
What about Fixer and
Ape?
Ogre.
Ogre.
And Human the real Sapien. Thunderbolts. Yeah. What about him, Kevin, huh?
What about Charcoal?
What about Daniel Axum?
Charcoal. They'll go to a bar after that battle and the bartender will be Daniel Axum. And they'll be like, hey guys, how's it going? And they'll be like, the Battler.
Oi.
That 8-year Thunderbolt review project will never stop paying dividends.
I mean, I still have other ideas to keep it going, so. The Thunderbolts project moves forever onward.
Well, Kevin, did you pick up Wasp number 1?
You know I did. I'll spoil everything. This is probably the best thing I've read recently.
There you go. It was good.
It was very good. I mean, well, part of that is probably because these first issues, you got to establish like what's going on with your title character. So it's like, oh, you get caught up on their like social life or what job they have now. That whole bit.
I think you were a little biased by your classic appearance in this, Kevin.
Oh, I was also biased by it's been too long since I've seen Nadia.
Yeah, I agree. I like that character too. Although, look, it's very beautiful. I think that Kasaya Nye and KJ Diaz did a great job. I kind of wish Nadia and Janet looked maybe a little bit different from each other. They look, especially, I mean, the hair is a little bit different, but if you subtract out the hair, there's a couple of panels where they're right, and you're like, wow, they really look similar together.
I mean, that's fair. I don't know. I don't think I've ever seen their art before. So, like, this wouldn't be their first Marvel work, would it? Like, surely they've done some anthology or something? I tried to look it up, and I couldn't find anything.
But I do love the conceit that we've seen in Ant-Man and some of these other retro ones where they put the fake digital Zip-a-tone over the flashback panels to give you the that's how they signify it's a retro story.
Yeah.
Which I always like.
The pixelated color.
Yeah. I mean, I would think it'd be cool if they really were buying like off of eBay old sheets of Zip-a-tone and everything. But I'm pretty sure that stuff is no longer usable at this. Some 40-year-old piece of art tech, I don't know, is going to be quite as fresh as it was.
So is there any other 60-year anniversary that you want Al Ewing to do for Marvel? Because he can do every one as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I mean, he's got to have Groots on the table, right? So, and I thought they did an awesome Whirlwind, by the way. Very, like, just trimmed down, classic, looking right. Not a lot of extra flash. The traditional outfit with the spinning blades and the proper bucket head.
Well, do you think the employer wanted him to go all classic? Do you think he asked, well, what costume do you want me to wear? And he's like, classic.
I thought you might be a little frosty that it implies that Whirlwind is not the mastermind supervillain of the Marvel U.
I mean, not really.
Are you waiting for the big summer event where it's Whirlwind behind everything, Kevin?
I don't know. I kind of feel like that's like the Punisher in that movie where he planned out all these elaborate deaths. And I'm like, I don't know if the Punisher would really do that. He would probably just shoot someone.
So you don't see Whirlwind getting his Norman Osborn moment for some big series?
Probably not.
No, I really liked it. I only had the first issue, but I intend to get more.
I keep reading limited series that I've let go by the wayside as the issues pile up and either finish up or almost finish up. And I read the All Out Avengers series that was written by Derek Landy with art by Greg Land and Jay Leisten, the old Sojourn team, right? But at least Land and Leisten, not Derek Landy. And I found this between the way that Greg Land's panels are very static. And
characters are yelling?
Or smiling and looking over their shoulders or whatever. Between that and the storyline, which has characters not being sure if they're being mind controlled or not, or if they remember what happened right or not, I found the whole thing very confusing and was really flipping through the pages. But then I got to the last issue, issue 5, which featured Spider-Man on the run from the Avengers with a doodad, some MacGuffin that he's got to get from point A to point B. And the Avengers are chasing him, and it's just like everything slowed down, and it's like, I don't care about all the other stuff that I didn't understand. This is a very enjoyable multi-page chase scene through New York with the Avengers chasing Spider-Man, and they each think the other is being mind-controlled and is the one that's wrong. And at the end, there is maybe three or four switcheroos that have you going back and forth a little, and I may have said the wrong number just so you don't count the switcheroos and allow yourself to enjoy the story, because at least this one issue was very enjoyable, as it was the finale issue. Maybe the whole series could have just been this one issue. But what was very weird, though, is that this series is going to continue in another limited series by the same creative team, that instead of All Out Avengers, it's going to be Avengers Beyond. And the last few pages of this issue has Captain America turning and seemingly breaking the fourth wall and talking to the reader. I know you're there. I know you're watching. This isn't over, you know. And at the end, he's talking to the Beyonder, but he's like talking to you, the reader. And it was actually, even though it was ridiculous, it was actually very powerful the way that it was delivered. And they use a full page splash to end the issue, end series, even though it's going to be continued. But I guess the Beyonder's coming back.
Wait, so you know, I grabbed the first, I had to get Balls Out Avengers, because, you know.
Right.
And I kind of quit after the first issue, but you're saying.
Understandably so.
Jump to issue 5 and pick it up.
Yeah. or wait for it on the Marvel Unlimited and enjoy a nice straightforward. And there are things that are nice and enjoyable about Greg Land's art. There are things that I can find enjoyable. And I found this issue to be, you know, like a video game level. Spider-Man's got to get from point A to point B with this little doodad, and the Avengers are trying to take it away. They don't want to hurt each other, but they are trying to stop each other, and it's kind of fun.
That leads to a minor spoiler that I have, if you kids don't mind. I have the first two issues of the Monica Rambeau Photon.
Yeah.
Eve Ewing.
Oh.
Ivan Fiorelli and Luca Maresca, and I very much like old Captain Marvel and Photon. We've been reading those Avengers recently, and I have fond memories of that team, and this plays with that. But the same kind of thing in issue 2, Steve, the Beyonder comes back, and I'll be honest, it kind of made me put the issue down. Not that I haven't enjoyed some Beyonder, but I feel like that's a character that we can really needs to go sparingly. I just feel like it's, and I know, I guess this is because of the MCU or whatever, but I feel like maybe put him back in the shelf for a while, just because, I don't know. And I'm sure there are Beyonder super fans who are yelling at me right now saying, hey, I got a full back tattoo of the Beyonder. Dog you. But for me, it just kind of stopped the story a little bit. And I was like, oh, because I thought it was clever. They're kind of mining her past with the Avengers and a little bit with Dr. Druid and that whole time period in the second issue, Steve, which ties right in with the She-Hulk, Black Knight, Thor, Avengers, and playing with all that. But then with the Beyonder behind it, I don't know. Just not saying I haven't enjoyed some of this. We all love Secret Wars 1. It's the event that started events and sold a lot of questionable toys from Mattel. I'm staring at Baron Zemo right now. With the weird little blaster and shields they gave everybody. But I don't know. For me, it's a character I feel like we're seeing a lot of. It was in the Defenders recently and just...
Yeah, you know, that's what makes me feel sad when people go, the Beyonder's back. And I'm like, if you would have read the greatest Marvel comic of last year,
right,
you wouldn't have said he's back because he's already been here.
And he's been retconned so many times too, you know? That's...
Yeah, I just feel like those kind of omnipotent characters break stories more often than not and just get bogged down. And like you say, with all the retcons and everything, I don't need I don't know. And like I said, you can do great. Look, no character is beyond a great story, but I just feel like.
Good pun.
Whoa, man. Let's let him marinate a little bit back in the although it makes sense because, you know, Photon was with the Defenders for a while. So, yeah, I don't know. I just really like the character a lot. Glad to see her getting her own story and kind of, and I thought it was smart to like play with her past because I presume, you know, that way when the next wave of the MCU stuff comes out, if people are like, oh, what's up with Photon? They can grab some of the series and get sort of a bit of her history behind it.
Better than them grabbing that Thunderbolt series to see, I wonder what she's up to.
Yeah. She's a spy.
Kevin, she is the key Thunderbolts. And of all the history of Thunderbolt characters, it's her and Axum are the two.
Oh, this is depressing me.
They should use Songbird in that role to come back and be the, you know, nullifying force in the team.
Well, I went back in time.
Moderating.
All the way back to 1999.
Whoa. Did you party like it was 1999?
Sadly, no. If I would have remembered, I would have locked myself in a time capsule as I was blowing one of those noisemakers. I would have woken up in the future where the high evolutionary controls everything. Hear what I'm saying?
Hearing that if you were back in 99, you would have been scooping up a lot of hot books from 1999 in mint condition and sitting on them until you could bust them out in 2023 to make some big sales.
I mean, that is correct, although they've tanked in 2023. But yes, yes.
Holding the line at $1.99.
Oh, no. So, I have a couple issues of this Spider-Man Unlimited series. Yeah, not that one. As the cover says, incredible stories based on the awesome animated television show. They're really selling it. So, it seems the way the editorial page is back here in the back of the book that this came out just before the show on Fox Kids?
No. I don't.
That's how they set it up. Oh, and they have a whole episode guide and everything.
All right. I don't know. I don't remember it being in that order, but okay.
I mean, it's weird because it's like the first two episodes in one issue, but
mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think there's some interesting choices made. Because I had to rewatch the first episode.
Oh, cool.
And part of the second episode again. And I'm like, I wonder how well this... Because I do say, like, teleplay by. But the actual team on here is Eric Stevenson and Andy Kuhn. I don't know if you know these guys.
Sure.
It's a little indie humor there. But yeah, they do... Like, The show is straightforward. They'll just start off with all their backstory, blah, 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 and get to the, you know, action and the stuff they want to get to. I mean, they do have some action with, like, Venom and Carnage on Earth.
Do they mimic the art style of the cartoon? Does it look like the cartoon, kind of?
I don't think exactly. Like I think this is better in some ways than the cartoon. I mean, the cartoon does have a sequence where they dig out Spider-Man's mask from the rubble, and on the cartoon it looks like there's a bullet hole through Spider-Man's head. And you look at the comic and that's not here. So I'm just like, what? But I find it funny they do Andrew's trick where they go where his space shuttle is already crashing on Counter-Earth, and they don't explain anything, and he's just fighting a bunch of, like, X-51 androids. And then they, like, they'll fill you in later on, like, what happened, just in a and a little flashback. And it's funny, like, the first episode would be, like, the whole flashback is sort of, like, most of that episode. And in here, it's just like, oh, we'll just give that a couple pages.
I watched that cartoon a couple years back when I was Disney Plus. I was fishing around for stuff. And it's only, what, a couple seasons or something? I
think it's not even.
So it was kind of interesting. Like, it was a fun sort of counter-Earth. Like, I like the high evolutionary characters. They're always fun. It's got those atomic steeds and everything. Like, yeah, it was just a fun cartoon thing. But it's different watching it 20 years later, obviously.
No, yeah. I think I've covered it, reviewed it before on maybe sub-episode 200, Marvel Noise. I don't know. It was a long time ago. But yeah, I feel like I've read, like, maybe plot summaries or ideas or something, like, past the episodes that they made. I don't know. Like, some of those series, they had, like, plans, and then you find out what the plans were. And it's like, oh, but the series got canceled. So this was just a lot of fun picking out, like, hey, that's the same dialogue, or that isn't, or they made different leaps in storytelling or logic in here. Like, in the cartoon, they're like, oh, we're here to rescue Spider-Man. But in the comic, no, it's more like the good guys, the rebels, are, like, sabotaging the bad guys' base, and they just happen to be there at the same time. Or, like, these razors are supposed to, like, dig into Spider-Man to get his DNA. And then in the cartoon, they, like, never get that far. But in the comic, it actually goes right to cut him, and it breaks off on his suit. Because they don't really get into the suit in the comic. I'm like, how come they're not filling this in? And they don't even fill in on, like, the bad guy. I'm like, I can't believe, like the cartoon's giving this whole origin, the high evolutionary, that is nowhere to be seen in this first issue. But I believe that, like, this is the... I checked the next issue I have, and it doesn't say based on, so I'm thinking they're original stories after this. Like, it's always interesting when they do that, because I'm like, well, you might want to have something from the show at the beginning. Like, you're going to adapt something at the beginning, and then if you get enough sales, then you go into original stories. But by that point, people might be bored, because it's just the same thing, so you might never get that chance.
So how long did the comic last, do you know, or you just have an issue or two?
I'm not sure. I would have to look it up. I know it at least went a few issues. And then they advertise in here the Avengers cartoon at the same time, which is pretty awful.
Yep.
Yeah, so, I mean, the comic was probably better in that respect, too, because I remember picking up one of those issues. But yeah, it's the Power Rangers Avengers cartoon.
Yep.
So.
Hey, doesn't Whirlwind appear in that in one of those episodes?
I do appear in that show, too.
how dare you diss yourself, Kevin?
All right, let's end with one more Spider-Man thing, and that is his current status. In his regular series written by Zeb Wells, they're having a event, the Dark Web, where... there was an alpha issue, and there's going to be, like, an omega issue, and it's in Spider-Man, Amazing Spider-Man 15 through 18, Dark Web, X-Men 1 through 3, Gold Goblin 1 through 3, Venom 14 through 16, Ms. Marvel 1 and 2, Dark Web Ms. Marvel, I should say, and MJ and the Black Cat 1 and 2. And in these 18 issues, the basic gist is that Ben Reilly, the Scarlet Spider clone, is back. And he's still a bad guy, and he's still broken now. And he teams up with Madeline Pryor, the Goblin Queen, to use Limbo to turn New York into hell, like, you know, Inferno back in the day.
You know, I've never turned around so fast on an event thing like this before. Like, I thought it was very average and getting kind of mediocre, until all of a sudden it got injected with all this humor and hilarious things out of nowhere.
All right, that's a fair take on my experience as well. Overall, I think it's pretty ho-hum. I don't like what they've done to Ben Reilly, the Scarlet Spider, and all that. Not that I like the character that much to begin with.
That's the thing.
Like, are we sure he's not the original, guys? Are we sure? Right.
There's still a skeleton in the smokestack, isn't there?
Oh, no.
But the art on some of the Amazing Spider-Man issues, at least, is by Ed McGuinness.
Yeah, that's nice.
Draws some pretty images, especially with all of the limbo demons and stuff. And part of New York is like in limbo, and the Daily Bugle is working there, and they're still like getting the job done, and they're sending out, like, they've got like demons working as the reporters and stuff, and J. Jonah Jameson and Robbie Robertson are there, and the scenes with them are like absurd, but they're freaking hilarious too. Like, I find them strangely compelling and enjoyable, even though it's utterly ridiculous. It's like they make a break for it, and it's J. Jonah Jameson and Robbie, and they're like trying to get out of the equivalent of hell. It's like, just, it's just really weird. Really
Can
weird.
Can we just have the whole series be just them trying to run the Daily Bugle from Inferno, and then having demons of employees, and then they're just like, no, Jameson, angrier.
It reminded
J. Jonah Jackal, you didn't do it properly.
It reminded
say
me.
Say it, you want tasty pictures of Spider-Man.
Just say it, tasty, say it. I want tasty pictures. Yay, and they all jump and cheer. They like get off on the sickest stuff, and I mean, it really reminds me of that Paul Kirshner, Heronius and Bosch book where the guy, the medieval ne'er-do-well is stuck in hell, and hell is like a working community with, you know, you can spend money and earn money and have a job and have a life and all that. So it was just really, there were some absurdities that were fun about it. But
are we sure this is not like an SNL skit with like Jim Carrey or something?
There is another angle to it, though, that has merit, I thought. And I didn't think so when I started reading it, but that's the X-Men angle. The three issues of this Dark Web X-Men bit that has at least partially Phil Noto art has what I thought was an actual fairly meaningful advancement of the relationship between Madeline Pryor and the X-Men and Jean Grey in particular, and how they resolve the issues that are at hand are kind of clever and very grown up. I thought it had a pretty good resolution that felt like it was a meaningful thing, and I was satisfied by it without giving it away.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly had questions about this event, considering everything that's been going on.
It's a stupid event.
yes it is.
They've already done their Inferno thing a few years, you know what I mean? We've done this. Didn't we just do that Ben Reilly was a bad guy? I mean, it just seemed like, what?
Well,
but whatever.
That's the thing. He was a bad guy, and then he was a bad Spider-Man, and then they're like, oh, well, something's going to happen to him, and it's going to be real tragic. But I feel like he comes off more as annoying, and like, I don't like him, and I'm supposed to feel sorry for him, and I don't know if I don't always feel sorry for him.
The Superboy Prime of the Marvel Universe,
yeah, right. Well, my recommendation is if you're reading Amazing Spider-Man, read Amazing Spider-Man. Those issues have Ed McGuinness art, and they look really pretty, and they have the funny J. Jonah Jameson Daily Bugle in hell, in limbo scenes. If you're reading X-Men, you don't necessarily have to read the Dark Web X-Men stuff, but if you read that old Mutant X book, if you like the old Alex Summers Havoc, or have any nostalgia for his connection to the Goblin Queen and all that, it's definitely worth a read. I thought it was a good little tale. The other stuff is all tertiary, and proceed with caution.
Yeah, I gave a pass, although it does sound like maybe they were borrowing from the indie comic book realm with our old friends at King Bone Press. Sounds a little like Apocalypse Meh with the demons in the regular workplace working alongside humans.
All right, let's make that another episode of the Marvel Noise podcast. Thanks, guys, for being on, as always. Come back for some more semi-monthly merriment in the Mighty Marvel manner. And until Blastar gets a hangnail, make mine Marvel. Later.